Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to On the Weekend Edition. I am your host, Brian Pettaway. Thank you so much for being here with me this morning. I'll be here like every Sunday morning for about an hour from 9 to 10. And you know, every show I believe that we do is a good show. I'm very proud of the progress that we've made on the show and the guests that we've had. But today, I've got a pretty special guest. I've got Governor Wes Moore, who's going to be here today. He's going to share some of his insight on the questions that I ask, and it's a myriad of things that we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about racism, we're going to talk about marijuana, we're going to talk about abortion rights, and all kinds of stuff. So stay tuned for that. That'll be on later on. It's a very, very cool interview. He's a very good guy, and I think you'll enjoy the interview. I've also got the Petty here with me, like he's with me every week, and he's going to talk about the NFL and the MLB, the NBA, and the NHL. What I'm basically trying to say is that he's going to cover a lot, and that's a good thing. But before any of that starts, you've got me. You know, I like to do news and commentary, so I hope you're feeling great, because I'm feeling great. I've got lots to talk about this week, so let's get right to it. Obviously, there were a lot of things going on throughout the week, but one of the things that I wanted to talk about first was that crazy haze that was hanging over the city from the wildfires of Canada. I mean, I'm like a little kid. I don't know why I'm so fascinated, but imagine this smoke rode the air for hundreds of miles it traveled. And by the time it got to us, it was still potent enough in particulates to cause an air quality emergency. I mean, it was so bad that it actually shut down the Baltimore Zoo. I don't know of anything that's been so bad that it shut down the Baltimore Zoo, but it actually did. And I'm hoping that everyone is okay, because there really was a risk to the elderly and to small children. In fact, the public school system was warned to keep their kids inside, not to have any recesses outdoors Wednesday and Thursday. So this thing was actually a pretty big deal. Now, it wasn't as bad here as it was in New York on Tuesday. You could actually see an orange kind of haze just hanging over the Hudson and over the city of New York. It was amazing. It looked like something out of a sci-fi movie. And as bad as it was here in the States, Canadian officials are using only one word to sum up Canada's wildfire season, and that word is unprecedented. Those same Canadian officials are saying that from coast to coast, uncontrollable blazes in 9 of the country's 13 provinces and territories have devoured millions of acres of forest, swallowed up hundreds of structures, and forced more than 100,000 people from their homes and blanketed cities near and far from the flames and eerie clouds of toxic smoke. Like here in the U.S., wildfires are expected and happen yearly. But the outbreak of so many blazes across the country of Canada at this time of year is not normal. And the worst could be yet to come. If the rate of fire activity continues at its current pace, the country will suffer the worst wildfire season in its recorded history. Canada's natural resource minister also said that the amount of smoke pouring into the United States is also exceptional. Authorities from New York to Minnesota to Washington, D.C., they all issued public health alerts and urged people to stay indoors and wear masks to protect themselves from potentially toxic fine particles in the air. So the million-dollar question for me is, are the wildfires in Canada under control? And the answer is not yet. Now, there were 437 active fires across Canada early Thursday, and 248 of them were out of control. In the western province of Alberta, 73 active wildfires burned out of control until Friday. The west coast province of British Columbia had 82 active wildfires, and 29 of them were out of control. And honestly, the list goes on and on. To make a long story short, no, these fires have not been contained yet. They are still burning some out of control. And the United States has sent help to help Canadian officials and firefighters get these fires under control. Now, I'm not going to get on my soapbox like I tend to do sometimes, but Al Gore back in 2006 tried to warn us of exactly this in a movie called An Inconvenient Truth. It's a documentary about the warming of the Earth's core and how global warming was something that was starting, and we were going to start to see far more floods, more severe storms, and absolutely we're going to see a ton more wildfires. Now, of course, at that time, no one believed him, although he had science to back him up 100%. Congress decided that they were going to ignore his warnings, and of course, now this is what we get. So until we decide to truly get serious about global warming, not just as a country, but as a world effort, we're in store for some really horrific things. All right, locally, our boy Tank Davis, I mean, it seems like the saga of Tank gets worse and worse. Apparently, his mansion in Florida was burglarized and ransacked while he sits in a Baltimore detention center serving the remainder of his 90-day sentence. According to Michael Tomko, Tank's attorney, he wrote that personal belongings, including prized boxing regalia and several collector automobiles, were stolen from Tank's home in Parkland, Florida. Now, the concerning part is that the Broward County Sheriff's Office is investigating to determine the possible existence of other threats against Gervonta Davis. And as always, you know, I'll keep you posted once we find out what those threats could possibly be. You know, I know Gervonta is young, he's a multimillionaire, he's a very nice young man, and he's brilliant in the ring, undefeated, and I hope he stays that way. But what I also hope is that this thing that he did with his Lamborghini, and then fleeing the scene, and then, you know, moving out of his penthouse when he's been remanded to stay there, I hope that this teaches him a lesson. It's a very expensive lesson, not that he can't afford it, but at the same time, I just hope that he learns from this. But based on what he said on a Snapchat phone call, it doesn't seem like he is learning from it. He's saying that the judge that sentenced him to the 90 days is crazy, that she's just upset that he purchased a new property, and that he shouldn't be sitting in jail. I truly hope that someone close to Tank sits him down and says to him that the leniency of the sentence that was given to him was a true gift, and solely based on the fact that he had enough money to hire a great attorney who was able to explain to the judge and get through to the judge that Tank had a very bright future. Now, somebody needs to explain to him that it was a break that typically black men don't get, and he needs to come out, clean up his act, and continue to be one of the best boxers in the world. Also in local news, the commissioner Michael Harrison has decided to hang up his shield and call it quits after 4.5 years as serving as the top cop in Baltimore. He and Mayor Brandon Scott held a press conference Thursday morning to officially announce his resignation from the force. I want you to hear the kind of language that former Commissioner Harrison used. It was very odd to me.
So good morning. I'm here to announce that over the last few weeks, as you've heard, I've been in conversations with our mayor about my future and about the future of the Baltimore Police Department. And in those conversations, it became convincing to me that this was the most opportune time for me to pass the torch. And the mayor shares that vision that this is the right time.
He said that it became convincing to me that this is the opportune time for me to pass the torch. Let's break that down for a second. You know what's happening right now? I think the commissioner has realized that in the 4.5 years that he has been commissioner, the murder rate has not gone down and the crime rate has steadily gone up. And during that time, his autonomy, his authority, his ability to make decisions within the department as to what his policemen will do has also been lessened. Every time he wants to do something, it seems, he's stifled. The squeegee kids, he was told, we're going to put your men on the corners and we're going to watch these squeegee kids, but we're not going to interfere in any way. We're not going to talk to them. We're not going to do anything to them at all. Okay? Then the mayor said, we're going to impose a curfew, but we're not going to pat these kids down when they're out after curfew. We're not going to frisk them. We're not going to ask them any questions or harass them. And if they have to be taken to an after-hour facility, your guys, the police, are not going to have anything to do with that or enforcing that. So now the summer months are upon us. And what we know, and what Michael Harrison knows more than any of us, is that crime rates always skyrocket in the summertime. And if you have no autonomy to do anything, but you hold all the responsibility of it, and the finger is always pointed at you when things fail, he might be thinking, it's time for me to get out of here. And as he said, it is in fact the most opportune time for me to leave. Now, it's also rumored that the former commissioner has his eye on the chief of police job in Washington, D.C., and that makes sense. Now, he denies it, but he also said at the same time he loves being the commissioner, and he still has the juice to go on. Well, there's an open spot in D.C. right down the road, pays pretty good, the mayor doesn't bother you, lets you do your job. Why wouldn't you take it? I don't know. We will see, though. We will definitely see. At this same press conference, Mayor Scott announced that Deputy Commissioner Richard Worley would assume the role and the job of Commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department. Worley is a 25-year veteran of the force and was born and raised in Baltimore. You know, I'm hoping to get Michael Harrison to come on to the show. I have a ton of questions to ask him, and he might do it now. I mean, he's retired, and he has the time. So maybe he'll come on to the show and talk to me. And finally, Donald Trump. I mean, you can't go through a new segment and not talk about the Donald. Donald is breaking records and making history in this country. because he has become the first U.S. president, former or otherwise, to be indicted on federal criminal charges. Trump, who is now the leading candidate and contender for the GOP presidential nomination next year, is scheduled to appear Tuesday at a federal courthouse in Miami. The former president had kept reams of classified documents in boxes at his Mar-a-Lago resort in South Florida until federal agents raided it last year and seized the records. The ex-president said he's innocent, of course, and ripped the case as the box hoax. Now remember, Trump was just found guilty of sexual abuse in the civil case brought by E. Jean Carroll. And earlier this year, a grand jury in New York indicted Trump on state charges for allegedly falsifying business records related to hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and other women who said that he paid them to be quiet because he had had sexual relations with them. And Trump still faces two other criminal probes as well. Smith's investigation of the January 6, 2021 pro-Trump riot at the U.S. Capitol, and an inquiry in Georgia looking into whether he attempted to interfere with the presidential election in that state. Well, I mean, of course he did. I don't even know what the probe is all about in that situation, because they had the president on tape asking an elected official in Georgia to find him more votes. I mean, it's insane. But Trump's out there campaigning. He's drawing bigger and bigger crowds, becoming more and more popular, and the GOP is going to still support him. So all we can do, all I can do, is hope that he is indicted and convicted before Election Day. All right, so now I'm going to switch gears. It's time to catch up with the governor. Now listen, way back in September, when Governor Moore was actually running for the office of governor, he took some time and sat down with me, and we had a conversation about what he wanted to do when he became governor, when he took office. And so far, true to form, he has done most of the things that he has set out to do. Now, he still has a long way to go. He's only been off for 7 months. But he's pretty much done the things that he said he was going to do. And at that time, he told me that he was going to come back and he was going to talk to me and tell me how things were going in the campaign. So we got with his team and we scheduled another interview prior to Election Day. I think it was a week before Election Day. Well, the day that we were scheduled to have the interview, the night before that, his grandmother passed. And like my grandmother, his grandmother meant the world to him. So I knew that was a blow. I knew in addition to that, he had a whole bunch of people trying to get close to him to get an interview. And so that my opportunity at that time was probably slim to none to get another interview with him. Well, once he became governor, then I knew that getting an opportunity to speak with him again anytime soon was going to be very tough, because he's a very hot commodity and rising star and the Democratic Party. And everybody wanted his attention. Everybody was trying to get an interview. He was on The View. He was all over the country. But true to form, the man keeps his word. And a few weeks ago, I was notified by his team that he was ready to sit down and talk with me today. So the time that he's giving me today, because everybody's trying to get a hold of him, and he's a very busy guy, and he says no to a lot of people because he just doesn't have the time. But I do have the governor of Maryland here, the very first black governor in the history of the state of Maryland, and I am very honored to have him. So ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome again to the 1500 family and on the weekend edition, Governor Wes Moore. Good morning, Governor. How are you this morning?
I am outstanding. It's so good to be on with you.
I appreciate you. I'm honored. Listen, the first thing I want to say to you is thank you so much for coming back. I know that when you were a gubernatorial candidate and you sat down with me, you said that you'd be back. And when we scheduled for that interview, unfortunately, your grandma passed the night before. So, and I thought, well, once you became governor, that had probably escaped me. But here you are back again, and I'm so appreciative. You know, soldier to soldier, man to man, that you kept your word. So I appreciate that very much.
Well, listen, I appreciate you, and I appreciate your voice, and you know, and it is true. I mean, my grandmother, she ended up passing 5 days before Election Day. In fact, in my office, one of the pictures I have on my wall was one of the final pictures I have of her was her actually putting in her mail-in ballot for her grandson.
Oh wow!
And so I cherish that picture. And I cherish her, but it's great to be on with you.
Well, if it's true what they say, I mean, she knew the results before any of us did. So
that's right.
You don't have to worry about that. You know what I mean?
That's right. Yeah, and you know, it's amazing because she was by the end of her life, she was so weak that we knew that she was not going to be able to make it to the convention center for the election night, for the victory night speech. And she would always just say, you know, I just want to see him. I want to see him, you know, win this thing. I want to see him win the nomination. But I believe from the bottom of my heart that God gave her a front row seat.
I'm sure.
For the night of our victory night.
Without a doubt. Well, I didn't have a front row seat, but I was there, and it was a great night. It was an excellent night. I was shocked that it was called so soon. You know, it was a very, very early call, and I was like, what? I wasn't even set up for it. You know what I mean? It was great. But listen, Governor, and look, have you gotten used to hearing yourself be called Governor yet? Is it what you thought it would feel like when you ran for this office, to hear yourself called Governor Moore?
You know, it's wild because you know, I never run for office before. I don't come from a political family. I don't come from a political lineage. You know, none of this was given. And so it is wild that, you know, you go and first you just had to show you had to be willing to outwork everybody.
Right.
But the other thing was, you can't ever forget where your power comes from. My power didn't come from the establishment. My power didn't come from, you know, people who were in the game or in the system who were like, oh, we're going to pick this guy who's never held elected office before to be the next governor.
Right.
My power came from the people. And so that's the thing I think we just continue to stay focused on in all of our work. So it's never lost on me. And it's still very humbling to know that you are, you know, every day you're coming into an office that is, that's, you know, the oldest operating statehouse in the country.
Yeah.
You're walking past the statue of Thurgood Marshall every time
I
walk
right.
into my office.
That's right.
It's not lost on me, like, the power of the moment. But I always stay focused on don't forget who put you there and don't forget why you're doing this work in the first place.
Awesome. Look, well, I'm going to jump right into it. We're about 3 weeks away from July 1st. When, you know, recreational use of marijuana in this state becomes legal. Did you have any concerns about signing bills 516 and 556 into law? Did you have any concerns about, I don't know, traffic on the roads or it being abused? Any of those concerns?
No, well, I mean, one thing we knew was that this is what the people of the state asked for.
Okay.
They voted overwhelmingly for us to go into a recreational space for cannabis. And so the question was always just going to be, how are we going to make sure that we're properly implementing the bills? How are we going to make sure we're properly implementing the rollout, that we're going to focus on making sure that it's an equitable rollout?
Right.
And when I say equitable, that means not just, you know, not just social justice equitable, but it means financially equitable. How are we going to make sure that it's transparent? And that this is not a cloak and daggers conversation about who and how and all this kind of stuff. It needs to be an openly transparent process. And how do we make sure that it's quick?
Right.
Because the thing that I did know is that if you continue to drag it out, and if we're talking about not opening a market for another 12 or 18 or 24 months, what you're doing is you're continuing to allow the illegal market to continue to grow and thrive and gain market share. And so I knew that there were a couple focus areas that we had to get done. And so so there wasn't a hesitation about honoring the will of the people. But where it was, though, is that we had to focus on making sure that this rollout was going to be correct, that we were going to establish an office of social equity.
Okay.
That was going to focus on assisting businesses with their licensing process, and particularly those who have been disproportionately impacted by the war of drugs, that we were going to, you know, have a real focus on having the cannabis business assistance fund that's currently accepting applications for assistance to small businesses that
okay.
are entering into the adult use market. And so those were all things that I knew we wanted to we really wanted to target as well.
Okay. Is there any truth to the fact that it's more difficult for African Americans to get dispensary license than it is non-African Americans?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an absolute fact to it. And that's not just in the state of Maryland. I think you've seen that show itself in rollouts all throughout the country.
Right.
And that's why there has to be a measure of intentionality. And when you think about things like the legislation that we're speaking about, what it does is it provides my administration with the tools that we need to actually stand up a successful industry that will both remediate some of the worst impacts of the war on drugs, but then also being able to focus on making sure we're creating pathways. And so that does include things like the cannabis, the Business Assistance Fund, which is helping small businesses and particularly businesses by African-Americans, right, and people of color. But then it's also things like the Community Reinvestment and Repair Fund, okay, which is really focusing on community initiatives in low-income communities, and particularly ones that were hurt by cannabis prohibition. And so I think if you allow the market to do what the market does, the market will end up hurting people who historically have already been hurt.
Right.
So that's why we got to be intentional, and we need to be unapologetic about being intentional about making sure this rollout is actually going to be an equitable one.
Okay. Now, I'm going to drop a name on you that really concerns me. There's a guy that really concerns me. His name is Ron DeSantis, and I know he's down the road. He's down in Florida, but the things that he's doing, I think, are damaging and possibly something that a lot of other states will attempt to do, and that's remove African-American history from educational curriculums. Now, I heard your speech, your commencement speech, which was brilliant, by the way, at Morehouse, and I was very, very happy that you didn't straddle the fence on it. Can you be candid with my listeners and tell me what your opinion is on that?
Yeah, you know, when I was going down to Morehouse, I wanted to be very clear and thoughtful about what was the message that I wanted to send to these young brothers of Morehouse. And the thing that I told them is, like, you know, we can talk about some of the things they're going to be able to have to deal with, and some of the big challenges. But I wanted to highlight the fact that, you know what, one of the biggest challenges that y'all are going to be actually dealing with is this assault on truth.
Right.
And this assault on history.
Right.
And people trying to roll back and minimize your history. And I told them, you know, that we get into these debates sometimes, and you'll hear the arguments that people make, where they say, well, it's because we don't want students to feel discomfort or to feel guilt. And the more I continue to think about it, the more I scratch my head, because I'm like, that's not true.
Right. Exactly.
That's not the reason they're doing it.
Right.
They're not doing it because they are afraid of certain kids feeling guilty. They're doing it because they don't want you to understand your power.
Exactly.
Because, like, listen, I walk these streets in a way where, you know, and with a confidence and with a humility, because I know my history.
Okay.
Right. I know that I'm walking in the footsteps of Tubman, and I'm walking in the footsteps of Marshall, and I'm walking in the footsteps of Douglas. I'm walking in the footsteps of Cowboy. I'm walking in the footsteps of Reginald Lewis. I know my history. And because I know my history, you are never going to minimize me, and you're never going to minimize my future. And that is their fear.
Absolutely.
Their fear is that you're going to have people who understand their power. And our history is our strength. And so that's why I think we have to be unapologetic in the pushback against this.
How far do you think it's going to go? I mean, because as one state goes and gets away with things like this, other states will attempt who have that same agenda. How far do you think this will go? And do you think it's something that needs to be federally handled?
Well, I don't think we need to let this state get away with it now. I think there needs to be consequences. I think we need to make bigotry expensive.
I think
states need to be punished for this kind of behavior. And what I mean by that is this. It's, you know, both by how we're thinking about legislation, but I'm talking like this. If you have a conference in a state that thinks it's okay to ban history and ban books, who thinks it's okay to put children under investigation when they do book reports on Stonewall,
right,
or put teachers under investigation when you're showing a Disney movie that happens to have a gay character, or when you're doing things like saying that children should not be allowed to read, or we're banning the reading of The Bluest Eye or Beloved inside of classrooms. I think that if you're having a conference down there, take your conference out and bring it elsewhere. If you're starting a business down there, and you're starting a business in a state where women's reproductive choice and reproductive health is now being pulled and they're criminalizing it, go somewhere else.
Right.
Build your business somewhere else. I want people to come to Maryland because I want people to understand that bigotry should be expensive. That's the way you're going to end this.
You know, I did a show a couple of weeks ago, and I mentioned how you strengthened the abortion rights laws in the state. And one of the things I said is that by you doing that, a lot of kids are going to come to Maryland who are enrolling in schools now, and that enrollment mm-hmm. rate was going to go up. Was that something that you took into consideration?
100%. Okay. This is, you know, by being a more inclusive state, we're also going to be a more competitive state.
Okay.
We're actually in fact just recently just signed an executive order that actually focuses on economic competitiveness in the state of Maryland, and we're really looking at economic competitiveness in every single way. How are we asset mapping our state? How are we investing in industries of the future? How are we reducing the regulatory red tape? How are we increasing liquidity for small businesses? So there's a whole lot that we're doing to increase Maryland's competitiveness. But one of the things that we are talking about in the executive order is actually focusing on this idea that there is a political risk calculation.
Okay.
That we've got to factor in for some of these other places. And so if you're an educator inside of a state and you're now being told what you can and can't teach and the things that you're teaching are now being banned, come to the state of Maryland and teach. We've got an educator shortage here that we want to address.
Right.
If you are a student who's now in a, you know, in a University of Florida system, for example, and they have now just banned things like gender studies inside of your coursework. So literally the coursework that you were studying is now no longer allowed to be taught.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Come to the state of Maryland. So yes, I mean, I actually think that this is not just the morally right thing to do to create a more inclusive and open society. This is actually an economic competitiveness argument as well that we're planning on moving on.
Well, thanks for making me look like a genius, because I said that, but I wasn't sure. But it felt like it to me.
You were spot on. You were spot on.
Talking about education, what about here in Maryland, in particular Baltimore? What's going on with that? Because it just seems to not be very good across the board. Are you and the mayor, have you guys, that dynamic duo, have you guys gotten together and come up with a plan and how to increase the test scores?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, and you think about education, where I've said unapologetically that, you know, the education is going to be the foundation of everything we're trying to get done here. And if we can get education right, if you get public education right in a state, everything else is going to make sense and everything else is going to work. And so we're working where, you know, so you know, while the State Board of Education is an independent entity, independent from the governor's office, you know, we are working in close collaboration to make sure that they don't just have the resources and the tools. I mean, we made historic funding in this year. We put more funding in public education than any governor in the history of the state of Maryland.
Okay.
But also making sure we have to increase accountability, that it's not just about increased funding, but you want to make sure that the funding is being used wisely and being you know, processed for all the different entities that make educational success a greater reality for all of our kids. And so yeah, we're working very closely with MSDE and I know all the local districts are pushing and working very closely with us to make sure that they don't just have the resources that they need, but that we have proper accountability measures as well.
Okay, and I'm assuming that goes with crime as well, because where there's poor education, typically there's a lot of crime. And so assuming that you and the mayor are working on that together as well to come up with some kind of ideas to help reduce crime, in particular in Baltimore.
Absolutely. I mean, listen, there's no greater priority for any chief executive than making sure your people are safe.
Right.
It's the number one thing that you've got to focus on. It's the number one thing you've got to do as a chief executive. And that means, you know, really creating, as we call it, you know, the all of the above approach about how we're thinking about public safety here in the state of Maryland. And when I say all of the above, it does mean things like we have got to get these illegal guns out of our communities and out of our neighborhoods. People have way too much access to firearms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we cannot have people who are just armed to the teeth and bringing firearms everywhere. That is not making anybody safer. But it also does mean that you've got to not just increase accountability for people that are violating the law, but it also means we got to drain up this pipeline of people who fall into that category in the first place.
Right.
And that's why you do things like the record investments in public education. That's why you focus on job retraining and job reskilling and stop making it so that people, that the only options that they seem to have are options that are going to end up getting them in trouble or putting them on the opposite side of the law. That's why we focus on $110 million in our budget for things like mental health and mental health supports. And so we really are taking very much an all of the above approach approach where it is both about creating measurements of accountability for people who break the law. It means that we are going to support those who are in our communities and our first responders and law enforcement whose job it is to make sure the communities are protected. But also, I am not interested, and we cannot just simply think we are going to militarize our way out of this. That's not the way this is going to work.
Right.
You've got to approach both the pipeline as well as increase accountability.
One last thing. When I walk in around Annapolis, in particular around the dock, I feel a certain way. I feel the history, like it's not lost on me. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I feel like, I almost feel like my ancestors are looking at me and I can see what they saw when they stepped off the boat. Tell me about your march from the docks of Annapolis to your inauguration. What inspired that?
Well, you know, one thing I think people are realizing about me is I move with intentionality. We don't try to do anything by accident because I don't think anything is an accident, right? And when I thought about what was the message that we wanted to send on that morning, where I was about to be inaugurated as not just the 63rd governor of the state of Maryland, but the first African-American governor in our state's history, the only the third who's been elected in this country's history. And I knew I wanted to start down there because I knew that the history of our journey was important.
Right.
And something we should never lose sight on. So started down at the Annapolis docks, which is one of the oldest slave ports in our country's history.
Correct.
And as you said, you know, then marched with a couple hundred folks, marched from the docks up to the state house where I was sworn in. And by the way, the state house was built by the hands of enslaved people.
Yes.
And it was interesting because when people said, well, he's starting at the first minutes of his administration, he's starting with indoctrination. I'm like, that's not indoctrination. It's history.
Right. Right.
It's facts. And it wasn't done to make people feel bad. It was done to make people feel empowered.
Right.
That this is our collective journey. This is our path. And you are right where I think the fact that when people say, well, people are looking at us in this moment, it's true. And I think we're being looked at from both the past and the future. That the past is looking at us and they're hoping that we are honoring the commitments and the sacrifices that they made. And the future's looking at us, where they're saying that we, in this moment, they're hoping that we are building a better future because that's what they are going to inherit. And so I think those are the two, that's the vice grip.
Right.
But I think for all of us that we should walk through life understanding that we're being looked at from both the past and the future in the present. And that's why we've got to make every moment matter.
Well, I got to be honest, I was very impressed that it was a diverse crowd that was marching with you. Do you, because you're a hot commodity in the Democratic Party, let's be honest. Are you, and if you're looking to move on, are you concerned about you being too black of a governor for some constituents that voted you in that are not black? Does that cross your mind?
No, first, I'm not looking to move on. I'm loving what I'm doing. I am not going anywhere. I know for a fact I've got 1,321 days left in my first term, and I plan on going for a second.
All right, man.
So
okay.
We're having a good time, and we're going to keep it going.
Okay.
But the other thing that I know is this: we ended up winning this race with more individual votes than anyone who's ever run for governor in the history of the state of Maryland. We ended up winning of the 24 jurisdictions in the state of Maryland. We won 16 with a higher voter count than a Democrat had ever won. And here's what I know when you look at the numbers, because I'm a numbers guy. You don't get to those numbers by just winning African Americans.
Oh, absolutely not.
You know, and you don't get to those numbers by just winning Democrats.
Correct.
I think the reason that we were able to win so overwhelmingly was people saw that we were speaking to their issues. People saw that we were speaking to their lives, to the things that they wanted to do, and the hopes and the aspirations that they thought we could bring forward. You know, and I told people, I am who I am. And I'm influenced and I am shaped by the past that I've had, and I'm shaped by the history that I know and that I understand, and I'm unafraid to speak on it. But the thing that I also know is the reason that we won so overwhelmingly, and I think the reason that so many people in the state are excited about the direction that we're going in right now is because they know that every single day we're fighting on their behalf.
Right.
And that's what, and I think that's what not just keeps us going, that's also what continues to keep our support.
Wow. Well, listen, Governor Moore, I am so happy that you joined me. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking your time, because it's very, very, very busy time for you. So thank you so much for being with me, and I hope I get to speak to you again.
Listen, I am so grateful for you. I'm grateful for your leadership, and I'm thankful. Let's make this a repeated conversation, because it really is exciting to see everything you continue to do with our community.
Awesome, man. You have a great day, okay, and a great week.
You too. God bless, man.
All right, Governor. You too. Bye bye. Well, it's always good talking to the governor, and as he said, we will be talking to him again. But I know you hear the music, which can only mean one thing. It is time for the petty. Let's call up the petty and see what he has brewing for us this week.
Brother B, how are you?
I am well, sir. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. I know you hear the noise in the background. Let me tell you, Brother B, where I am. I am in the lab. I'm cooking up some things for the upcoming NFL season. Listen, Brother B, I'm trying to tell you, man, look, I looked at the schedule. Training camp will be starting next month.
Right.
That's how close we are to the NFL season. Training camp will be starting up. And I'm telling you, Brother B, I see some things. I looked at the schedule. Man, listen, they got some barn burners. And I'm talking about, let's just talk about this game right here. They got some division rivals going on. And I'm gonna look at this one game right here that I think got a lot of implications. It's going to be the first Monday night game of the season. We're talking about the Buffalo Wild Wing Bills going against the New York Jets, Jets, who now has Aaron Rodgers.
Okay.
Man,
okay.
That's going to be something else.
Where are they playing?
They will be playing up in the Meadowlands.
Okay. Are you going to this game?
Up in Jersey. Unfortunately not.
Okay.
But
okay.
I definitely will be watching it. That's going to be a big one. And here's one that just has me interested. I'm talking about the Packers going to see the Chicago Bears, where the Packers had always owned the Bears. But
okay.
Guess what?
What's that?
That man who I just mentioned, Aaron Rodgers, will not be playing for the Packers.
Exactly.
Let's see if that turns things around for him. And here's a nice one I like right here, too. Another divisional rival game. Jacksonville goes to Indianapolis to play the Colts.
Okay.
And I heard a little something about the Colts now that we're talking about them. One of their defensive backs may be not only suspended, but kicked out of the league on gambling allegations.
So that's
something
you got to
look at.
Yeah. I heard something about that.
Not to mention, Indianapolis may be leaving. Well,
what?
Colts may be leaving Indianapolis. They're looking at another site to possibly move their team. Let me tell you something, Brother B. I remember when Jim Irsay's father, Robert Irsay,
right,
was the owner of the Baltimore Colts. And he said on national television with his drunk self, I would never move this team out of Baltimore.
I remember that.
And that's when there was rumors floating around that Baltimore may be moving to Jacksonville, because he made a trip to Jacksonville. But no, he was good on that promise. But no, he didn't move the team to Jacksonville, but he moved them in the middle of the night to Indianapolis.
Right.
And now we have his son, who's the owner of the team, doing some unscrupulous things up there in Indianapolis and possibly moving that
unscrupulous
team.
Okay.
Now, I know you don't have too many hockey fans out there, but I'm telling you right now, Brother B, I told you I like this team, and they are getting it done on the ice. They are fire on ice. I'm talking about them Vegas Golden Knights. I like that team. I told you I like them. If you're ever a fan of hockey, you gotta check them out.
What's the series at right now?
Well, right now, we're looking at Vegas. Look, let me tell you something, Brother B. That thing is over. It's over. Give them the cup. We ain't got to talk about where it's at. They're just taking care of Panthers, those Florida Panthers, like it's nothing.
Okay.
Give them the cup.
Okay.
You know what? Florida was able to sneak by with an overtime win over the Golden Knights. But outside of that, this thing is going to go to the Knights. Give them the cup. Get them out of here. Now, let's switch to the NBA real quick. You know, like I said, I'm in the lab, and I don't even want to talk about these other sports. I really want to give them some football. But I got to talk about the NBA, and there are two players, and I'm talking about Jokic and Jamal Murray. They are a two-man team that are getting it done in Denver. Miami has made all types of adjustments to try to take down that dynamic duo, and I'm telling you right now, Denver will be getting that NBA title.
You think so?
And I like what I said. Oh, man, listen, you got two guys putting up triple-doubles. And I'm talking about they are getting it done. They're the champs. That's all I can say.
Well, before I let you go, man, I want to give you kudos real quick, because you said 2 months ago that Gervonta Davis would be spending some time in jail. And that's exactly where he is. So I heard it from you first, but that's exactly where he is.
Brother B, I keep my ear to the ground. I tell you, but I got something hot for you. I'm going to give it to you first.
Okay.
So now, you see how it is. And I'm telling you, in the next upcoming weeks, I will have some hot stuff for you on the NFL. Finally, well, not finally. One other note before I get to my final note. The XFL continues to send players to the NFL. They're trying out. They're still signing the contracts.
Right.
And the XFL will be back for another season. There will be some changes that I will hop on at a later date. But they continue to send their talent to the NFL. And it may be that the XFL might be the minor leagues for the NFL. Now, I'm looking for some players from the USFL to go to the NFL and once their season's over also.
Yeah, it's weird, man. The USL, I don't know if it's the coverage or what, but they just seem to play a much better game than the XFL.
They play a better game, but I'm starting to like that XFL a little better because they're a little bit more fan-friendly. They're in cities in which they're named after. The fans are going out. I'm seeing T-shirts. I'm seeing jerseys. And I like the XFL. I like the USFL better for the type of play that I see on the field, but I like the XFL also.
Okay, okay.
Now, on my final note, I'm going to talk about those high-flying O's. They are up and down like a freaking roller coaster. But you know what, Brother B? They are still part of that top three in baseball, and you gotta love it. We're in mid-June, and they are still flying high.
Right.
Gotta love those O's. Listen, like I said, I'm in the lab. I'm gonna be cooking up some picks pretty soon. I'm gonna tell you right now, give me about 2 weeks, Brother B, and I will give you a line on who I may think will win in week one in the NFL. Brother B, I gotta go. Love the show. Love what you had to say with the governor today. Keep it going. I'm out of here. Peace.
Peace, brother. Peace. Thank you, sir. You know, I always love talking to the Petty. I could talk to him all day. But, you know, on this show, I can't. So, got to say goodbye to him. And, you know, I got to thank again the governor for coming on today. It's always great talking to him. He's such an easy person to talk to, and he gets his point across very eloquently, and I appreciate his time that he's given us here at 1500 Radio. And, of course, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for joining me again, and I hope you enjoyed the interview and the show. But before I go, I wanted to mention a couple of things. One is that if you miss any of these shows, if you've missed them or if your friends have missed them, I don't have to replay them for you. You can go to my website, voiceswired.com. That's voiceswired.com. And, it's free. Just go click on the Weekend Edition tab, and you will see all of the shows archived, and they are chronicled